This is the Practice Human podcast, multidisciplinary movement, therapy, and contemplative practices for modern life. If you're a lifelong learner who believes in the inseparable quality of body and mind, a movement specialist dedicated to helping people live better lives, or a rogue explorer bucking the status quo, you've come to the right place. I'm your host, Caitlin Casella. Thank you for joining me on the podcast. I'm excited to bring you this talk today because it's something that I've been a part of and a group of people that I've been creating with since March for The Connective. The Connective is cooperatively owned and powered by teachers. We provide a sustainable livelihood for yoga and movement professionals and raise industry standards for quality, diversity, anti-racism, and accessibility. We offer students an online space to explore movement, build community, and discover new potential. Our vision here at The Connective is to ensure movement professionals have the tools to thrive and make the practice of yoga, movement, and fitness accessible to traditionally underserved and marginalized communities. We've been building our cooperative business from the ground up since March, and on this episode, I spoke with fellow founding members Tony Warner, Markella Loos, Sangeeta Vallabhan, and Liz Bueller-Walker about what it means to create a cooperative business model and our visions for the future and creating more sustainability and equity in the yoga, fitness, and wellness industries. Before we get into the interview, I just wanted to let you know there's links in the show notes so that you can find us. You can find us on Instagram at The Connective Studio. Practice with our teacher owners on our platform, theconnectivestudio.com. And we're currently raising money to support three endeavors to grow our business and expand our impact on the industry. And those areas are teacher support and advancement, technology, and community programming. So if you'd like to help us out by making a donation and supporting us in our mission, you can make a one-time donation or a monthly contribution via our Patreon page. There's links for those in the show notes as well. And I hope you enjoy our talk. Hi, everyone. Thank you for joining me today for the podcast. I'm really excited to have a few of us teacher owners here to talk about The Connective. And today I'm chatting with Markella Loos, Tony Warner, Sangeeta Vallabhan, and Liz Bueller-Walker. All of us, the five of us, along with a group of, I think we're a little bit over 20 or around 20 teacher owners right now, are part of a teacher cooperative with an online platform called The Connective. And I wanted to have a conversation about what we're doing and why we're doing it and why it's really, I think, relevant today in a lot of ways throughout a lot of different factors and facets of the movement, fitness, yoga industry right now. Let's start our discussion with Markella Loos. Markella has been a guest on my podcast before with Unionized Yoga. And the reason we're all here having this conversation today is because Markella continued some of the work that she started in Unionized Yoga here in New York City to then start The Connective. So Markella, maybe you could start by talking about your background with organizing, how you started organizing teachers, and how that work and those values have been brought over now into our cooperative, The Connective.
Sure. Thanks so much for having all of us on. I'm really excited to have this conversation with everybody. Yeah, in some ways, you know, you're right. It does feel like what we're doing at The Connective has been a continuation of the work that we started with Unionized Yoga over a year and a half ago at this point. And one of the things that I want to point out, especially at the beginning of the conversation, you know, talking about that relationship, is that unionizing was never in and of itself the goal. It was always a tool. And in our case, it was a legal right that we had as employees at YogaWorks to try and raise industry standards and create a more just and sustainable profession for teachers. So it's very easy for that work to transfer not only into The Connective, but into all kinds of other things that like serves the same ultimate goal and mission. And it also, like, the other sort of similarity they have, and something that I've come to like really see throughout this work is that, you know, without changing the power imbalance, the inherent power structure and imbalance, sustainable and meaningful change isn't really possible. And so with our unionizing work, that's what we were ultimately trying to do at YogaWorks, is shift the power imbalance where the company had all the power and teachers had zero to something that was a little bit more of an equal relationship. And in the structure of a co-op, that's inherently different, which is so cool. So like from the bottom up, all the teachers that everyone sees on the platform are all teacher owners. And there's, we have bylaws, we're having our board elections right now. And so there's checks and balances to even our own internal power dynamics. So the connective is also responding to a need for teachers to really have a voice and a say in the direction of the profession and the industry, and to help create a more equitable and sustainable landscape. And I'm really proud of all the work that we did with Unionize Yoga, but I also recognize where our efforts were sort of stunted or limited in some ways by the existing business and hiring practices of that company. And so by contrast, for me now, it feels super like open and creative to be generating this from the ground up. And so instead of trying to like nudge a behemoth to change its ways, it's like, you know, we get to create what we want to see in this industry. So one of the most important ways that I feel like we've been able to make changes where I felt like our work in unionized yoga was limited is a union is made up of as employees. And I think at YogaWorks at the time, it was like either 10% or less identified as BIPOC. And so the union and therefore union leadership also reflects those percentages. And that's obviously super limiting in so many ways. So the fact that we've been able to create a diverse group of founding teachers and start off by bringing issues like cultural appropriation front and center, and community agreements and anti-racist practices and all of that, it feels so different in that sense from the work that we were doing before. So much more, you know, generative and open in that way.
Yeah. And I think that component of building from the ground up is what allows all of those components to be a part of, you know, our value system and our work and how we build kind of everything on that foundation of those. And we'll get to the community agreements and the statements on cultural appropriation and anti-racism as we continue the discussion. But yeah, it's like starting from scratch is, I think, has been useful and interesting, and it's a very creative process that I'm excited to be a part of. Let's go to Liz, because I'd like to hear some of your perspective as well as someone who has worked with the unionized yoga group within YogaWorks, and now you're here as a part of our cooperative with the Connective.
Yeah, I'm so happy to be here on with you, Caitlin, and everybody else. And yes, to everything Markella said, it has been an interesting year or so of Markella and I getting to know each other and working together. And I agree completely that there's a thread for sure with the organizing from what we were doing with unionizing over at YogaWorks in New York and what we're doing now with the Connective. And there's also a lot of difference there. So the way I'm thinking about a lot of things right now in terms of systems and change and what's happening with the COVID and the quarantine and the economy and the uprising and awareness of racial change that needs to happen and justice in this country is what are the places, the systems, and the people who are too calcified to really change? And so, you know, I think about YogaWorks and when we were unionizing, that there was a structure in place that as when we unionized, we did not have much power to change.
Right.
Almost like it's a sculpture. And we were able to like paint the sculpture differently, but we couldn't, we could even maybe turn the sculpture on its side, but we couldn't change the shape of the sculpture. Some sculptures are more malleable and able to be changed in terms of their actual shape. That one did not seem to be that way. So I'll use a specific example about Yoga Works, which was Markella brought up the fact that, you know, Yoga Works historically had their own hiring practices and lack of diversity in their teaching staff, and particularly in their upper management and executive team. So what we were able to do potentially was in a contract have an influence on how people were hired, how teachers were hired, how teachers were promoted, and perhaps get the ear of the executive team. So one of the things that we pushed very hard for when we started contract negotiations was committees, so that we would have access to the upper management who were really making the decisions, and repeated access to them so that we could give examples and say, this is where this needs to change, this is how this needs to change. So we asked for a labor management committee. We had put in the contract a health and safety committee. We had put a diversity, equity, and inclusion and cultural respect committee in there. So three different committees. When they came back with their counter proposal in mid-March, the official representative for the company said, we will give you a committee, one committee for all of those topics, consisting of one person. That committee was their one. Committee. And actually, I'm laughing, but it's one of those things where I'm laughing because it's so just absurd. And it's I actually meant to say before I told this story, this is upsetting to even say this and have this out there. But I'm laughing because of the absurdity of it and mm-hmm. the shock of, are you serious? You're coming, like, you feel good about that being your solution. Of course, they're saying something very different now, right? At mid-June, the tune was a lot different. But yeah. In mid-March, that was officially the counter proposal to what we had proposed in the contract. Cut to the pandemic happens. Markella initiates the connective. Conversations start happening. And we have a chance to create the whole structure around yeah. that. And the thing about it being a cooperative is that it's a living, moving, changing structure. Mm-hmm. It's not a calcified scaffold or, like, you know, a building that's 300 years old, you know, made of brick and mortar. It is something that can be changed while it's being built, which is something that's happening right now. And it's something that we can initiation of it, make a difference in terms of who has power, like who has power to say the direction that this goes, who has power to say what we will and won't do and what will and won't work, that are people who are coming from lived experiences that they can participate with. So that feels a lot different, right? It's like taking this sculpture that's hard and baked and trying to do something with it versus actually building something and choosing materials that have not been used before very often, that are friendlier to adjustment and mm-hmm. growth and a container that can hold things in a way that shapes around what needs to be held instead of forcing things into this strict structure.
Hmm.
So I just, you know, what Markella was saying just reminded me of that very specific example. And that you have a visceral feeling in how the work feels to have been doing it within these particular constructs versus leaning into a group doing the work, forming the shape.
That's really interesting. Thanks for that. I love that image of the sculpture. It's really helpful. Markella, do you have anything to add about organizing just from the labor side?
Tip the sculpture over. Hopefully it cracks. No, that was what I was thinking as Liz was talking. Well, I think there's like, maybe we talked about this in the last time we were on for unionized yoga, but I think there's such an interesting relationship between organizing and like activism in the practice of yoga. And I very much see organizing as being in relationship, and I see being in a cooperative as being in relationship with one another. And so, you know, hopefully in a good relationship, like there's a lot of deep listening happening. And so that's a big part of how this started. I mean, I saw a moment, you know, when COVID hit and everyone started moving online, I saw a moment where my knowledge of the industry and my experience in organizing was useful, and where my skill set was unique in being able to help with that. And then, like organizing, starting the co-op was also a lot about having lengthy conversations with people and doing a lot of listening and trying to understand where they were coming from, what their needs were, what their vision was for the path forward. And I think that's like a really important, it's not the fast road, but it's, I think, the most effective road. I don't think you can really take shortcuts with this type of stuff. On the one hand, having that longer conversation or ongoing conversation helps people feel invested because they see themselves and their opinions reflected in the work and in the outcome and what's taking shape, what sculpture we're building. But it's also a way that, like, without those conversations, you miss a lot of important things you wouldn't otherwise know. You miss sort of being able to put together a comprehensive picture. So like that was the one aspect of organizing that definitely played into the early days of the connective. And the other part was, like, as an organizer, I sort of see my role as making sure people realize that their experience, that they're not alone in their experience or their struggle. And through all of that listening, like having a vision that sort of something bigger than each person individually that everyone can hold on to and move towards. And I think that's important too, like having the vision or the inspiration is really important in people not feeling stuck and helpless and like moving people into action.
Yeah. And I think there's a lot in what we're doing that helps with that, just in terms of the ways that we can support each other as a group and share resources. And I know we've been kind of talking a lot recently about how we can be in a place as a connective where our students have access to all of us as teachers and like the diverse offerings of the teachers in the group and how we can collaborate on various offerings based on our expertise. So there's like so much intermingling, I think, of our experiences, our expertise, what we have to offer students, and our skill sets and resources that we can pull together to create a power in numbers and the way that we can support each other. Liz, do you want to add anything else before we move away from the, like, this was that was before and this is now?
I wanted to clarify that when I'm talking about the contract negotiations, it was early on in the negotiations. And so we don't know where we would have ended up being able to get with a contract, because then the pandemic came in a big way. And then eventually YogaWorks permanently closed all of their New York locations. And so the union wrapped up by negotiating for severance and the closing of those locations. So we did not get to the end result with the contract.
Markella, you have something to add?
Sorry, I kind of got going now.
It's all right.
Which is also fucking historic. Like, there has not been a severance package for yoga movement teachers ever, the way there wasn't a union before. So what I raised my hand to say was, like I've sort of heard this from friends or like anyone who knew what we were doing of sort of being like sympathetic of us of like, oh, Yoga Works closed and that sucks, like all that work that you put in. And I'm like, it's not lost, like at all. Like mm-hmm. the work that we did, A, is continuing both with some of us now in the Connective, but also there have been so, I don't think it's possible to know the impact, the full impact of something that you do in the moment, and maybe not for a good deal of time. And so because, you know, something that folks might not realize or know is like, I have had so many conversations with teachers and even studio owners that came from the press we did from that, that came, you know, conversations that were started through that effort that are continuing. And so just because you don't see the ripples anymore doesn't mean they're not still moving.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to say that because I think it's important for anyone who's trying to organize in this industry or in any industry, like you kind of have to do the thing and you might, and be okay with not knowing exactly what the impact was, but that doesn't mean there was no impact.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really important that like the work, it's like none of that effort goes to waste, right? Even in terms of the learning curve, the learning process. And I know you've gone through so much of that, Markella, just figuring it all out as you go and in talking to people and putting together all the pieces of like how to shape something from scratch, like Liz was saying, how to create with all the materials in a way to like, we create something that is like what we want to see. Yeah. Liz.
I do think that it had a wider impact too, at least in our community in New York. And we did have communication with people all over the country and even internationally with unionized yoga. That is something that I'm seeing now. And I used to own a brick and mortar yoga studio. I co-owned it with Mel Russo. And from 2008 to 2013, I was there. And then she kept it going until 2015. On the Lower East Side in Manhattan. And there's something happening now with COVID, and it's complicated and it's bittersweet. And the bitter part is that, you know, small businesses are suffering and closing, and many yoga studios are suffering and closing their physical spaces. Many of them are continuing to go online. And there is a reckoning that's happening that needs to happen. And I think it's also similar in terms of like who and what and where is too calcified to adjust and open and shift and be humble and make repairs. And I'm not talking about physical repairs. I'm talking about mm-hmm. emotional, spiritual, and harm repair. So one thing that is happening that is pushing some of this forward in terms of what is yoga going to look like? Places are closing. They're pausing. They're hoping to reopen. Will they reopen in a new way? Let's hope. Will the places that are too calcified and need to stay closed stay closed? Let's hope. But the teachers and the students and the staff from those places are realizing that they have the power of divestment, and they have the power to change where they're practicing, how they're practicing, who they're practicing with, who's teaching, where they're teaching. And early on in this process, I mean, you know, Tony, I've heard you talk about experiences and needing something different and better. Sangeeta, I've heard you talk about, you know, needing and wanting something different and better. I certainly have needed and wanted something different and better. Caitlin, you've gone through your whole shift and pathway that you've gone through. And early on, Markella, you said something that was said, maybe if there are better places for people to be, then they don't have to choose to be in a shitty situation. So maybe if we can create a place where people are like, yes, I want to be there, then they will divest from a place that's causing harm to them or to others. And then they'll come and participate in a way that is meaningful for themselves, meaningful for community. And I think that that's something that you know, my heart goes to studio owners and brick and mortar people, but you know, I've been there and it's hard, and I've, you know, closed a place and had to make those tough decisions. And sometimes that has to happen. You know, sometimes you have to change your structure completely and the way that the power is structured as well. So I just think it's really cool to see. And I think that, you know, this union, this historic union forming is part of that. People being like, wait, whoa, 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 wait a second. Do I really have to do it this way? Mm-hmm. And that includes the practitioners and the movement and yoga students as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Liz. Let's turn the discussion over to the student perspective for a moment. Tony, when you first joined us at the Connective on one of the early meetings, you just something really struck me about the way you spoke about the students' perspective and our responsibilities in what we have to offer the students in terms of our, you know, the high level of expertise in our teaching and our offerings, but also creating a welcoming space for students. And I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on how both what we're doing with the Connective and also maybe this migration to the online space in your experience, if it has supported students in a different way, or how it has supported students in a different way. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
When I was coming to the Connective, you know, I was going through a lot thinking of what does it mean to care for my students? What am I offering my students? And am I in the best place to offer what I define as care? And I think one of the best things that we can do as teachers is to offer the most unwatered down, the purest form of knowledge that we can offer it. From whatever modality it's coming from, does it honor the roots of yoga? Is there an answer to every single why? And is it guiding students back to themselves, right? So that they can care for themselves. And I think that the Connective, I know that the Connective is a place that does that. Through the accessibility and pricing structure alone, you know, being able to not have to say, well, I have to choose between my groceries and yoga, right? Like maybe this week, this is what I'm paying. This week, this is what I'm paying. The next week, I can pay a little bit more. And it's here for me. You know, there's no complicated contract structures. There's mm-hmm. nothing, there's no commitment, even though I'm trying to commit to myself as a student. And I think just the tenets, you know, we're going to talk about the community agreements later. But honoring the original voices of yoga, the traditions of yoga is a very big passion of mine. And the fact that there is no studio dominant culture, you know, we're teaching to this branding voice, mm-hmm. or, you know, we can't use Sanskrit, not that you have to, but if you'd like to, it's there, right? So students have this option with whichever teacher they're taking, whatever they're paying. There's this high level quality experience. And by high level, I mean pure and not whitewashed. And I, you know, we all sit in meetings and we've had these discussions about what do we want to leave behind from studio dominant culture? What do we need? Like, what do we see and recognize as, okay, yeah, we kind of need that. So let's build a plan towards that, right? And that's valid. But I think at the end of the day, through the pricing, the various teachers, I mean, there's everything there. Pilates, dance. You know, if you want to hear someone talk about philosophy, come take my class. If you want to do yoga with your right scapula and your left pinky, I think about Caitlin. So there's so much. And there's so much community because we can actually look at who's with us. Regardless of the virtual connection, I still feel very connected to my students. Mm. And I can say, you know what? I know for a fact that this teacher is going to suit this need that you have. that I can't fill. I think that's also another thing is how this, you know, there's a support of the teacher that trickles into what we offer and can be for our students. The competition is not there, it's stripped away. And then we have all of this marketing support. And because we're not held to this teaching voice or these standards that we get evaluated on, I have worked in places where I had to follow a certain structure when I was teaching or a certain baseline sequence or whatever it is. And it prevented me from showing up wholly, you know? And so that in itself, just the idea that the way I feel when I teach here versus the way I might feel teaching at another studio is a very completely different thing that my students notice. And then I can say, this is me in all my parts. I might not be showing all of it, but this is me in all my parts. I don't know how to teach to your scapula. I just don't. So go to Caitlin's class. something particularly particular, you know, go here. And it just, all it does is it brings people to this place where no matter where they go, even if they have their teacher, no matter where they go, they are connected to and aligned with people who are being just as discerning with divesting, right? I think now, especially more than ever, students are very, you know, very mindful about who they're taking class with, what are the studio policies, has the leadership, the ownership been abusive in the past? What actions are they taking? Now, where can I go where I don't see any of the things happening to the teachers that I value?
Yeah.
And so I think giving the connective gives people that power. And that in itself is a form of care.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the class options, the building of community. And also, you know, I think it's a wonderful, you know, if you talk about marketing, there's a lot of transparency in how we present ourselves. So teachers make this amount of money when you know, we created these tiers of pricing for you because of this thing and this statistic that is a common trend in the studio culture. And students get to see that information and digest it and make choices for themselves. And even if it doesn't mean that they're taking a class at the connective, at some point in time, it's like, as Markella was saying earlier, at some point in time, it's going to register, you know what, I'm taking this class at this popular studio and my money's not even supporting the person who's supporting me as a teacher. You know, yes. So over time, like the information that's being put out, in addition to the quality of the classes, the accessibility and pricing, the open schedule, I think that's also a thing, you know, a benefit too, in terms of the virtual space. There are all so many forms of care.
Hmm.
And it creates this ability for people to care for themselves and care through others by joining in to a like-minded community. It puts yoga into action as it gives people accessibility to yoga.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you. What Tony was saying about our transparency in terms of what goes to the teacher, when a student purchases a class on the connective, it shows exactly which percentage goes to the teacher and which percentage goes to the connective as our mutually owned business. So everybody knows when they buy the 85%, this is no secret, 85% goes to the teacher, 15% goes into the connective, which is owned by the teacher. So then it goes towards improving our site and our platform and growing out our resources and hiring continuing education presenters for our teachers and all of the things that help our business and our teachers grow and thrive. So I wanted to mention that, and then I'm going to see what other thoughts Markella has on this.
I wasn't actually trying to speak. I was going like this for like Tony.
Oh, she's sorry. Excited clapping. Okay.
It was like little virtual clapping. Sorry.
Awesome.
I don't know. Like everything you were saying, Tony, is like, I don't know. It's like music to my ears. I love hearing that that's how you feel about the space and that that's the experience that your students are also receiving. I think that's like, I'm not teaching on the platform, so I don't get to see that part of it. And so it's really cool to hear that. So,
yeah, I mean, I'll tell you all a quick anecdote, whether it makes it to the cut, I don't know. But I have a student and she pretty much stopped going to studios and she practices with me whenever she can. It's pretty often, I think. She did an interview and she told me that the connective was like 60% of the interview because she works in policy change and policy like making, and she used the connective as an example of how you can put your foot in the door and enact change. And so many of my students are obsessed, I'm going to use that word very loosely, but they're very, very, very happy with the option and this whole new idea of I get to do yoga, I get to find myself and hang out with my friends and my teacher. And what I'm doing is creating change that's so much bigger than me doing a downward facing dog on my mat.
Yeah.
Yeah, the response that I'm getting from my students has been overwhelmingly supportive and very well received.
That's great to hear. Thank you, Tony. It's interesting, like in our social media presence, to see how a big component of this and something you touched on, Tony, when you were talking, is educating the consumer on what they're buying and where that money goes too. So I've also been like a little bit surprised, not surprised, that students are like, I had no idea, you know, like don't realize how little of what they spend in a like mainstream yoga studio actually goes to the teacher. And so it's eye-opening, I think, for them to see this level of transparency and to then see that this isn't at all how things are in other places.
Yeah, and I think there's just it creates a very real picture. I think so part of the connective is obviously creating sustainability for movement teachers. And I think I definitely, before I became a yoga teacher, I thought teaching yoga was a whole different ball game.
Yep.
Then I became a teacher, then I decided to do it full time and I got a swift kick, to quote Markella, stretchy pants. And and then you go from studio to studio to studio to studio and you realize that students or people are taking your classes and no one really knows what's happening behind the scenes, and it's not their job to know, but it also it creates value. And I think that it's really important that for teachers, it's important that we are feeling valued and held and honored for what we offer so that we can continue fully offering to our students, because we know that they see the full picture, even though it's not their responsibility to know it.
100%. Yep. Sangeeta, I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on this as well.
Thanks, Caitlin. It's great to be back here with you and to be here with everyone from the Connective. I wanted to add on to Tony's thoughts and her beautiful reflection on the student experience. And I think she even spoke to this a little bit about herself. I know for myself and my teaching journey, I feel like it's been like quite a roller coaster. And I'd been teaching at a studio for about the past 5 years, where we weren't allowed to chant. And I love chanting, and I used to chant a lot in my classes, and students would kind of come for that. And I mean, they knew that when they were coming for my class, they would sing. Like, we would sing before we started moving. And I definitely feel like I'm in a safe space to bring those components back into my teaching. Mm-hmm. I haven't gone to the place of doing a chant, like a full out chant in my classes yet, but I do feel like it's a safe space to do it. And I feel it from my peers that I'm with, but I also feel it from my students. I have a lot of students who are coming who've known me from those days of chanting, and I want to. You know, like I've been talking, having different conversations about cultural appropriation and with different people and listening to other podcasts and just realizing for myself as a practitioner and as a teacher, this is an aspect of yoga that I love. Hmm. And for me, when it's not there, it's a little bit incomplete. Yeah. For me.
Yeah.
So I feel like I'm in a space where I can do it when I'm ready.
What you just mentioned, Sankita and Tony, it's something that I hear come up again and again in our meetings, that this space for teachers creates an environment where you can be all of yourself as a teacher in so many ways. And it's so interesting to hear it echoed again and again here, because I keep hearing it echoed again and again in our meetings. And it's so important. Markella, did you have something to add?
The question that comes to mind when I hear what Sankita and Tony are both talking about, which is so beautiful, is like, why is that not happening elsewhere? Mm-hmm. That's such a glaring problem to me in this industry, where the teachers who are the professionals, they are the ones that have dedicated like countless hours of training, who know the material and what they're offering inside and out. Why do they not have more agency and more voice in order to provide the experience that they clearly know is like the most sort of comprehensive, complete experience for students too? Like, mm-hmm. why are teachers in traditional structures not trusted to offer that? Why do they not have a voice in what should be in the room? You know, like these restrictions that you're talking about. I've definitely taught places where, you know, you had to do adjustments, or you had to not do adjustments, or like whatever it was. And I realized that like maybe early on as a teacher, like guidelines are helpful and a container is helpful, but we're talking about folks who have been teaching, you know, for a really long time and are like seasoned tenured teachers. It seems like a dumb business practice, honestly. Like, I don't understand.
Well, and there's also, it's treading a fine line of being illegal in an independent contractor status, right? When someone's hired as an independent contractor to fulfill a purpose or a role or to offer their services in their way, there's a limit on, and you know, this gets, there's a lot of gray area and it gets pushed all around, especially in this industry, but there's a limit on how much control a company can have over how that person does their job. But so many teachers are hired on an independent contractor status with no benefits and can be fired at any time with no notice, and asked to then, you know, not be fully themselves in the way that they offer their own expertise. So Sankita, we've already talked on the podcast, and for listeners who are new to Practice Human or new to this episode, you can actually, side note, you can look back, and I've had conversations with both Markella and Sankita, and then a conversation with Unionized Yoga that Liz and Markella both participated in. So if you're looking for a little bit more after this talk, you can look there. But Sankita, I wanted to kind of now continue our discussion from before about reducing harm for teachers and reducing harm for students, and how the work that we're doing in the connective and going against the status quo can help with that. And also the work that you've done for the connective, authoring the statement on cultural appropriation with Avita Bansi. So I'd love to hear a little bit more about your work on cultural appropriation and reducing harm.
For me personally, I've had an interesting relationship with cultural appropriation. I've heard the term for years now, but I never fully understood it. And I've also, I've fully recognized that I've kind of been in a unique position, ironically, as a teacher of South Asian descent. When I started teaching, I did get opportunities to teach. And I never felt slighted or felt like I wasn't being given opportunities for whatever reason. I do feel like I was given opportunities. So I didn't have that experience of being discriminated against. I think when I really started like teaching yoga full time, I had trained in a method that incorporates a lot of traditions from India. They incorporated chanting, which I loved, and they used a lot of Sanskrit. They incorporated a lot of philosophy and scripture, and I did their full training, and it's pretty rigorous. And the people who do well from, or not, I don't want to say do well, but the people who really take in that content and can deliver it well, it's really amazing. And in general, I never felt that it was disrespectful. I think there were a few instances where a few South Asian people would come to my class, and they would come and I'd be like, oh, well, that's cool. and then I would never see them again. And it was interesting, the people, like the South Asians who would come to my class, they kept coming, and then there would be like another group of people that would come and then I would never see again. Sometimes I would hear from people that they don't like going to yoga classes because they feel like the teachers are being disrespectful. They don't really know what they're talking about. They don't understand how sacred all of this is, which I think that there's a lot of validity in that. I heard from other South Asian students, you know, what they were experiencing, that they didn't like going to yoga classes. They felt like the teachers were being disrespectful. They weren't fully acknowledging how sacred the practices were. I think it would sometimes be weird for them to see someone, not just white, but maybe someone non-South Asian, sitting on like a platform in front of them and leading them through these practices that are inherently a part of their culture. So I, through the connective, I had the opportunity to work on a statement, a culture appropriation statement for the connective. And I co-wrote it with Avita Bansi. And Avita is great and just so knowledgeable about topics around race. And just she can talk about these issues with a lot of complexity, but very clearly. So it was really great to work on this with her. But the other thing is, like, she and I both have very different experiences growing up and being South Asian and growing up being South Asian in the West. I say West because I grew up in the US and she grew up in Canada. So we basically came up with a list of not rules, but like guidelines of how to be as teachers teaching this modality of yoga, making sure that people have not just knowledge, but like an acknowledgement of all the different subjects under this bigger umbrella of yoga, like not just asana, but also pranayama and meditation, philosophy, Sanskrit, and knowing that you don't have to be an expert in all of these things, but understanding their value and their weight and their place and using them in your classes when appropriate, when you're using them, citing your sources appropriately, citing lineages appropriately.
I think one of the interesting factors with the teachers in the connective is that there are many of us who are offering other movement modalities such as Pilates or dance fitness. I teach something that I just call like movement classes. But my background is heavily influenced by yoga. And I'm wondering if you could also speak a little bit about how for those of us, because I think a lot of my listeners are interested in this too, for those of us who have a lot of inspiration and background and things that we've learned from yoga and from teachers of yoga and lineages of yoga, how we can honor the roots of yoga, even if what we're presenting, what we're teaching isn't explicitly yoga. Like, for example, I bring in yoga poses as examples of come into this stance. It's like a Virabhadrasana one, like warrior one stance, that is coming from my experience in yoga, even if we're doing like a standing bent over row with a kettlebell, you know, that there's kind of a weaving together of influences that can still honor, I think, in some way, citing that source or bringing in that experience from that tradition.
There are a lot of teachers on our platform that don't teach yoga specifically, but I think, I don't know if I would say all of them, but I would say at least most of them have come to whatever movement modality that they do teach now from yoga.
Yeah.
And that even if they don't explicitly teach it now, there is still that foundational knowledge in whatever they offer. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, it doesn't have to be like so, I don't know, like robotic. Like if Caitlin, if you do a warrior one and you have your students row with a kettlebell, you don't have to go into a whole spiel about where you learned warrior one from.
Right, right.
But I think there's like just like an underpinning of respect of like where it's coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think one big thing for me is like the use of Sanskrit. I've trained teachers for years now. I've trained teachers since 2009 in many different programs. And I get really befuddled when I've been taught to guide people to not necessarily use Sanskrit. Mm-hmm. And that if they can't get it, you don't need to, don't worry about it. It's fine, just use the English. And for me, that's completely disrespectful of yoga and where it comes from. And it's just another language. That is all it is. So if you have trouble learning Sanskrit, that's perfectly understandable. At one of my teacher trainings, I was in like a small mentor group, and we were going around the circle and practicing, going over answers on like a quiz or something. And so when it came to me, I had to read one of the sutras. And my mentor was like, we need to work on your Sanskrit. Because I grew up in Lubbock, Texas, and I didn't grow up in a big Indian community. That's just my personal experience. So learning how to speak Sanskrit when teaching yoga was not easy. I had to work at it.
Yeah.
And just like I presume just about everybody else. And if you don't use it, you're dishonoring the tradition. If you encourage students at a teacher training level that if you don't get it, if you're not able to catch on to using Sanskrit, don't worry about it. You're creating the foundation of disrespect. And I've seen it. I've been in the training where I've had to do that. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to sit here and I'm going to teach them, but I'm going to teach them, you know, that you have to put some time and effort into this, and you should, because you're at a yoga teacher training. There was one other thing I wanted to add, like when it comes to cultural appropriation and why it's important. situations that a lot of what I'm describing, I kind of, for lack of a better turn of phrase, like whitewashing. Mm-hmm. And so it's like considered like the whitewashing of yoga, where you take out the Sanskrit, you don't use any philosophy, you don't speak about or acknowledge any of the roots of yoga. This is problematic mainly because it erases the complexity of the people whose culture is being appropriated.
Yes.
So that's like the biggest underpinning of the importance of cultural appropriation.
Hmm. Tony, what do you have to add?
Sangeeta, ooh, you are speaking to my heart and my mind. I would love to see teacher trainings include modules on cultural appropriation. And the reality is that if we're teaching yoga in a studio, it's appropriation. And I think part of, like, I'm a Black woman and I cannot tell you what it's like to wear some bamboo earrings and it's called ghetto, and then someone else who's not Black wears it and it's fashionable. And so cultural appropriation resonates so much with me. And it's really, you know, I've been in teacher trainings. I am currently, you know, I lead teacher trainings and co-lead teacher trainings. And it's something, unfortunately, that isn't really, like, we don't really dive into why you would be wanting to use Sanskrit, why you would be wanting to talk about or bring in philosophy. And also, I think at the helm of cultural appropriation is, are you just passing on information or are you giving people knowledge? Hmm. And what is the difference between the two? It's experience. So yes, you should be teaching pranayama. Yes, you should be offering mudras and bandhas and all of the tenets of the spiritual and physical practice of yoga. But is it something that you actually practice? And if it's something that you don't actually practice and really, 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 really know, then there's no why and basis for what you're offering. And that in itself, I think, is super problematic. Mm-hmm. Because then you're just giving people information. You don't really know how to hold space. You wouldn't be able to answer why you're using Virabhadrasana 1 versus Warrior 1, because there's a difference, right? I think this is a topic that really, really should be at the cornerstone of all 200-hour teacher trainings, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm so glad that we're talking about this.
Thank you. Yeah, me too. And I know, Sangeeta, you and Avita are working on building out your material on cultural appropriation to hopefully create something that could become a module that that could be added into yoga teacher trainings.
I totally agree with Tony that cultural appropriation should be added to teacher trainings. I also think trauma needs to be added to teacher trainings, because when you're walking into rooms and you're constantly just encountering the general public, you, as a yoga teacher, and the material that you're presenting and the experience that you're giving people, we all need another level of sensitivity.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the cultural appropriation pieces that many teachers grapple with is using the word namaste and how it's used and in what context it's used. Maybe you could share some thoughts on that.
You know, it's funny, I used namaste at the end of my class for years. I think I've only stopped using it in the past few years, maybe the past 2 or 3 years. Namaste, to some South Asians, is a very sacred word. And what has happened in a Western context with now what we're in, which is a huge billion-dollar industry, is that this sacred word gets altered and used like I've seen it used for something regarding moms and yoga for moms and calling it Mamaste or Namaste, like N-A-M-A-S-T-A-Y, Namaste in bed. Mm-hmm. I heard that. For me personally, it's not offensive because I don't have that experience of feeling the sacredness of the word. But I do acknowledge that there are other fellow South Asians who are deeply, deeply offended by the word being, you know, basically bastardized in some way. Another thing that's, I guess you could say it's kind of funny, because most of my teachers have been white. You know, there's a definition of namaste, or a loose definition of like, the light in me honors the light in you, or the divine in me honors the divine in you. So that's basically a Western construct. And that is not the meaning of namaste. Namaste is basically a greeting.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to use it in a class, use it at the beginning and use it in a way that is respectful, in a respectful tone and space at the beginning of your class. But using it at the end is like saying hello instead of saying goodbye. But also that meaning, which I've said as a yoga teacher, I've said, you know, the light in me honors the light in you. But that was what I was taught. But that's like completely incorrect.
Yeah. I mean, it's even become like an email signature,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah. And I've even seen some teachers who are in the forefront of yoga, the combination of yoga and social justice and racial justice. And, you know, they'll say something like, bring your hands into namaste. Like, this isn't namaste. You know, so it's like, you know, I don't think they're bad for doing that, but it's like all these things that we have to kind of unlearn. And I've heard also about people being really offended by a non-South Asian yoga teacher using namaste in class.
Yeah, it's become so ubiquitous at the end of class that it's I don't know. I've heard a lot of conversation around how if teachers have been using it consistently at the end of their class, it's like, what do I say at the end of class to signify class is done? And I think that's one of the things that I've heard a lot of teachers grapple with recently. You can say thank you.
I say thank you.
Thank you. Right. Yeah.
Thank you for coming before COVID. Thank you for practicing with me. Thank you for taking the time to practice with me. I think thank you is simple and direct and appropriate.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for sharing that. I'd like to finish up our talk by discussing some of the main tenets of our mission statement at The Connective. Our work here at The Connective is to create a sustainable livelihood for yoga and movement professionals, and to raise industry standards for quality, diversity, anti-racism, and accessibility. Markella, as our kind of founder, trailblazer, who came over with this initiative to start The Connective, I'd like to hear some of your thoughts on how we've brought diversity into this group.
It was definitely something like that was very important to address from the beginning. And as I mentioned earlier, and Liz mentioned too, like it was not something that we had a lot of success in addressing in our short campaign with Unionized Yoga at Yoga Works. So to me, changing things in this industry is incomplete without also increasing representation and diversity. And I definitely, you know, in the beginning, I'll admit that I did not know as many teachers of color as I would have liked. But I recognize this as a systemic problem and chose to like not just feel ashamed about it, but like actually try to change that and seek referrals and have conversations and really try to make it be something that, like, it wasn't, it certainly wasn't like, oh, check, you know, like, we're going to set everything up and make all the rules, and then we want to bring in some BIPOC folks afterwards. It was imperative that our structure from the ground up and during the decision-making process included diverse voices and lived experiences. And something that I can't speak to my own experience as a white woman, but that I heard in my conversations with teachers too, is that, like, it makes me think of what Tony was saying earlier of, like, not being able to show up as a whole person.
Tony, what do you have to add?
I've definitely been, I mean, I said it earlier, I mentioned it earlier. I've definitely taught in places where I didn't feel like I could show up wholly, like, in for all of, you know, I didn't feel like I could show up all the way, or if I wanted to chant or do or talk about philosophy. I talk a lot about philosophy when I teach, and I've been in places that have told me, stop doing that, don't own, or, you know, places that expected me to teach to hip hop. And I wouldn't know why, because at no point did we talk about what music I listened to. And so there's definitely, you know, one of the things that really, that I wake up to every day as a Black woman who teaches yoga is, chances are, if I'm walking into a studio, I'm not represented or reflected by my students. And that's life. But then also on top of that, I'm typically, if I'm not the only Black person on staff, I'm one of very, very few Black people, Black folks. And then there's this, you know, in addition to that, you're a Black woman or a person of color teaching, and you have this knowledge you want to share. And because of a brand voice, you're being asked not to share parts of you that you know. And it's almost like, well, is this the conversation that you have with everyone, or is this just the conversation you're having with me? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really what allows me to show up is knowing that when we are in meetings, when I'm teaching, you know, even if I'm not virtually surrounded by the people that I work with at the Connective, I'm reflected throughout the other teacher owners. So I'm not sure, I can't remember what the statistic is. Is it that we are half teacher owners are BIPOC and the other half are identify as white. And so I think that is a huge trend, not a trend, but it's a big need in the community. I think to give autonomy and a voice to teachers in general, but then also ensure that power and that voice and that ability to show up is also available to teachers who are often underrepresented. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're all making the same decisions together. We're all making, you know, we're all getting access to the same tools that support us as teachers. And so even though we're not all teachers of color or we identify as teachers of color, when we make a decision and put it out there, it's coming from a diverse place, which I think is, you know, it's really cool. And that is what I think our students see. Mm-hmm. And that creates the diversity amongst students and also the ability to create accessibility, because each of us come to the table with thoughts and offerings that come from our own unique perspectives. And so decisions have the whole in consideration versus just a select group.
Mm-hmm. Liz, do you have something to add?
Yeah, I think that what Tony is talking about also points to why the cooperative structure is important, that it is teacher ownership. And so the decisions are made democratically and the power is distributed equally among the teacher owners. And so it's not that there are half BIPOC teachers and half white identifying teachers, and then one particular person at the top who holds the power as a studio owner, for instance. But that the power, you know, we came up with some agreements as a group for how we were going to interact with each other, community agreements. And we didn't go deep into those in this conversation, but one of the things that we have agreed to is to look at things with a power analysis. And so to always understand that power is happening, power is in the room, power is at play, and to acknowledge how it is working and if we want it to be working that way or differently. So I think it's another reason why it's important to just talk about the fact that this is a teacher cooperative, and that, that's just important.
Well, and I think it's this foundation of, again, like starting with new materials to build it from the ground up through an anti-racist lens. So it is incorporating all of this, you know, unlearning that's required to dismantle white supremacy so that we're not building it up in that model. Yeah, Sangeeta.
I just wanted to add to what Tony and Liz were talking about regarding diversity and inclusion. I feel like most of the places I've taught have been mostly white. And I think I was starting to notice in the past few years how homogenous the perception of yoga has become. Mm-hmm. And what has been a beautiful experience with being on the connective and having diversity within our group of teacher owners is that there's so many different experiences that are added to the pot, and it just feels more rich. And it doesn't feel like we're trying to copy that version of one thing. And I think that that's a huge part of what's lacking in the yoga industry is diversity in imaging, in representation, not just South Asian teachers, but teachers of color. If you Google yoga, I mean, it's a bunch of white teachers. Mm-hmm. And I think that it's for me personally, it's been really gratifying to be a part of a diverse group and to experience how rich the experience is, as opposed to more homogenous versions of what I have previously taught in.
Let's finish up by looking a bit into the future, and this can be 6 months into the future or 10 years into the future. Maybe you can each touch on just a little bit of where you see our work headed with the connective or with the industry as a whole.
From the beginning of thinking about the connective, I always wanted it to be something that grew to include a lot more teachers. And I hope that, you know, we're slowly getting to a place where we can expand beyond the 20 founding teachers to include other folks as well. There's been a lot that we've had to sort of figure out and sort out on our own before it felt responsible to open it up more broadly, and didn't want to add on too many things and make something so like cumbersome and weighty that it would just sink. Mm-hmm. So definitely wanted to get it off the ground. But going back to what Liz had brought up earlier in the conversation, for me, part of the power that we have in actually affecting change in the industry comes from power of numbers. And it also comes from that divestment. And so by bringing on more teachers and giving more teachers an experience that is not exploitative and is generative and where they have a voice, my hope is that more teachers will be able to make choices and have more leverage and more power in the decisions they make about where they do want to teach. So mm-hmm. teaching at a studio becomes a real choice and not the default because that's your only option.
Yeah. It's great.
So I am very lucky. I am on the fundraising committee, and both Markella and Liz are on the fundraising committee with me. And there's this running joke because we had to dream big and like list all the things we wanted. And I'd said that we would be this like huge philanthropy, like giving place, and we'd have a gala. But that's not what I'm actually going to say. Surprise, surprise. I am very passionate about continuing education. And I'm very, very passionate about teacher trainings. I think that where we can enact change is how people are being taught to teach yoga. And the quality of teacher trainings and the standards of teacher trainings, like what qualifies something to be a 200-hour, what qualifies something to be continuing education accepted, quote unquote accepted, I believe needs to shift. And we touched on this earlier regarding cultural appropriation. So I'm looking forward to see where our efforts that we've been talking about in fundraising, how they affect education and especially affinity-based education. So maybe I want to learn something functional and I can learn something functional. Maybe I want to learn how to teach to adaptation for people who, I don't know, lost a limb in a war. I don't know. Or maybe I want to learn how to curate classes for Black women based on the historical pathology of their bodies, right? And so I'm looking forward to seeing where we can enact change there and provide opportunities for more teachers, more folks who are underrepresented in the multiple ways, economically, socially, racially, to have opportunity and access to teacher trainings and education as well.
Great.
What I would like to see for the future in the yoga and wellness industry or industries is alongside anti-racism work, and I guess this speaks more specifically to yoga, is for to encourage people to hold space for anti-racism, and specifically in this country, like it's deeply been anti-Black, but to hold space for that and cultural appropriation. Because you can't be anti-racist and not care about cultural appropriation. Like, I want people to really be comfortable with holding space for both.
Thank you. Liz, final thoughts for the future?
Somebody in this conversation, I can't remember who it was, used the word generative. So my thoughts for the future, for the connective, for yoga and fitness, and in my life in general, for the future is life-affirming action, which includes the anti-racist work. It includes, you know, understanding and addressing cultural appropriation. It includes divestment from dominant white supremacist culture and collaboration across all kinds of difference. And so I'm just looking forward to being along for that ride, right? And sort of like being in a place where lots of creativity and collaboration is happening. And I will be at the gala, and whatever theme is for the gala, I will get the dress or the costume or the suit or the, you know, yoga clothes, whatever it is that we're supposed to wear to the gala. I will be as creative as I can be with that. But yeah, so I'm really, collaboration is really what excites me about this. And when I think about material that we're offering and how we're working together I see, and expanding outside of our own organization, I see collaboration is what's coming to me right now.
Thanks.
How about you, Caitlin?
Oh yeah, I know. I was like thinking I should probably say something. I know. Now I'm like in the interviewer's seat and my brain's like, you don't know what to say. I'm looking forward to the connective as a structure that supports shared learning and shared understanding. Like, we have so much to learn from each other, and I've already learned so much on a lot of levels. So, like, I've learned so much about collaboration, organizing with people as a group, hearing, like, not just hearing, but really listening to other people's experiences and perspectives, and then thinking about how this collective can serve all of it and make space for all of it. I've always been like the kind of person that's like, I just take on everything and do it all myself. And I mean, you guys probably, some of you have probably seen my, just like the way that I'm just like, let's do this and put it down on paper and da-da-da-da-da and bullet point. Cause that's the way my brain organizes things. But to be in a place where I can look outside of just my brain trying to make lists and organize things and take in more of a collective experience and information from other people who see things from a different place and have a different experience than I've had is so valuable. And I think so necessary for everyone in the world to be doing that kind of work right now.
I was thinking that, like, as we were talking of like how amazing and beautiful it is to me to have all these different topics in the same conversation, and how that's so much of what we're doing at the Connective. Like, it's not mm-hmm. one thing, it's interdisciplinary, it's like multidimensional, all of these, like, labor and cultural appropriation and like diversity, like all of those things need to coexist. It's not like one or the other. So I thought that was like so cool listening to everyone share yeah. their thoughts. And
every piece affects every other piece.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're all amazing. And like, this kind of conversation is why I want to be doing this. So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you all. I'm excited to put this out in the world. I think a lot of people will be excited about it.
Thanks, Caitlin.
Thank you.
Bye.
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 Thank you so much for listening. And if you're not a part of what we're doing at The Connective already, I really hope that you'll become a part of our community, either as a student practicing with our teachers or potentially as a teacher joining for membership in our cooperative or supporting us by making a donation. Again, find us on Instagram at The Connective Studio. There's a link to our platform in the show notes. It's theconnectivestudio.com. And if you'd like to help us in our mission and make a donation, there's links to make a one-time donation or support us monthly via Patreon, also in the show notes. So thank you again. And if you're enjoying the conversations here on the Practice Human podcast, please leave us a rating and a review. It will help the conversations grow.